Welcome back to Tech Hygiene. We help you stay sane in a crazy world. Say hi to your hosts, John Biggs and Lauren Feltman.
Welcome back to Tech Hygiene, the podcast about surviving in an increasingly complex universe. How's your universe doing, Lauren?
It's doing well, actually. I'm back in California after 40 days, 40 nights in New York, and raring to go.
You always sound like it. You always sound like you're just raring to go.
Always.
Always. So what do we got? You know what? So we have this new session, this new little section, little segment that we're going to put in. My friend Adam Levine, he's been doing these things for me. He knows that I like watches, and he also knows that I like AI. So what he's done for us, and I'm going to play this just in a second, just as sort of like a moose boosh. He's had an AI write a watch review for us. And he's going to describe it, and he's going to read it for us, and it's pretty hilarious. Are you interested in doing this?
Absolutely.
All right, let's give this a go. Let's give this a try. And then after that, we have actually a guest, our second guest that we've ever had. And I think this what we're going to see how this format works. But first, let's talk to Adam.
Hey folks, you're listening to Tech Hygiene, and this is a new sometime segment called Watching for the AI Apocalypse with Adam B. Levine. Now, some of you may have heard of this new wild thing called AI Predictive Text Generation. To understand this concept, think about autocomplete on your phone. You type F, U, and it figures out what you really mean is duck, or something. Basically, it tries to guess what word you're writing so that you don't have to. It's sort of useful, I don't know, I'm not really a big thumb typing fan, but either way, keep the idea in your head. Now, instead of guessing the word you're typing, these new AI algorithms from creepy Silicon Valley companies are now able to predict not just what word you're typing, but to finish your sentence, your paragraph. Hell, it'll write your whole document for you and do a darn creepy job of writing in your voice to boot. So, for example, if you start a document and write, "This is a recipe for red-flavored jello by Stephen King in the style of his epic post-apocalyptic novel, The Stand," you'll wind up with a very creepy cookbook indeed. To those of you for whom this is new and surprising, welcome to the future! It's already here! But we're not at Skynet levels quite yet. Now, for those of you who don't know, Tech Hygiene host John Biggs is a longtime wristwatch enthusiast. He runs wristwatchreviews.com and generally has an unhealthy level of interest in the anachronistic accessories. In this segment, I'll be sharing with you unedited, AI-generated wristwatch reviews, trained off of just two of the tens of thousands of detailed write-ups John's published over the last 7 decades. The idea here is that while the technology is pretty impressive, we're not quite to the levels where you could literally replace John with a computer without anyone noticing. When that happens, we can know the AI apocalypse is nigh. So let's get into our first review. To kick us off, I had John make up a watch that doesn't exist. It's the only piece of information that we gave it. We provided the algorithm with the name. That's it. This is untouched by human hands. We only generated it once, so this is a first try, not some cherry-picked thing. Without further ado, I present to you the Zodiac Fisherman's Friend. Watch name: The Zodiac Fisherman's Friend. Headline: Zodiac takes its name literally with the new Fisherman's Friend. Review: The Zodiac brand is best known for their military-inspired field watches from the 50s. With its heavy-duty cases, broad bezels, and durable utilitarian designs, those pieces are the epitome of tool watches. The new Zodiac Fisherman's Friend watch gives a cheeky nod to the company's storied past with a graphic interpretation of their most iconic look. The new watch has a vivid red crest and broad bezel that looks like it could take a serious beating. It depicts an intensely graphic fisherman struggling against a fierce, golden fish-like creature. The effect is unlike anything I've ever seen before in a watch. The rest of the dial is dedicated to displaying the hours and minutes with clean white numbers and inverse accents, making them very easy to read at a glance. The sleek hands of the watch also help in this regard, as they're sharply designed to be immediately recognizable from a distance. This would be a bold timepiece with any bezel design, but Zodiac have chosen wisely by going with a graphic interpretation of their classic fisherman's logo. It's one of the most exciting watches I've seen recently, and it manages to be unique without sacrificing usability, which some avant-garde designs lack. Still, I don't think this innovative design will be for everyone's tastes. The elaborate crest and use of strong colors can be a little jarring for someone not expecting it, and may not fit with certain aesthetics. However, if you're looking for something different, this is certainly a departure from the usual watch selection. And at under $200, this is an affordable collector's item. So, let's get to the critique. The headline is pretty good, quote, Zodiac takes its name literally with New Fisherman's Friend. I'd rate that a 7 out of 10 on the Biggs-like scale. The review itself feels nicely complete, covers the price and various accessories. It has some nice asides that we'd see in a classic Biggs-style review. Talks about durability and has nice descriptive phrasing, you know, with kind of that New York flavor around the whole thing. One area I found particularly amusing and less realistic is the logo the AI decided must be present to justify the name. Quote, it depicts an intensely graphic fisherman struggling against a fierce golden fish-like creature, end quote. That's really the only visible flaw that I saw in this review. John probably would have described it as a golden fish or a goldfish rather than a golden fish-like creature. Why on earth would a fisherman's watch feature a fish-like creature rather than a fish? That's the giveaway here. But overall, I'd give this a strong 7.5 to maybe even 8 out of 10 on the Biggs-like scale. So, at least for today, we're not at the AI apocalypse. But it's coming fast, and it's a trend we'll be watching. Thanks for listening. If you have any questions, complaints, or suggested fake watch names, you can email me at adam@speakingofbitcoin.show, or just complain to John directly and I'm sure I'll hear about it. Until next time, back to you, John and Lauren.
So that was pretty freaking fun. We're going to have those every couple weeks.
Let's get Brett Hurt here.
Right. Yeah, let's get Brett Hurt on.
So, Brett Hurt.
Yeah, hey. How are you guys doing?
Welcome.
We're well. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate you having me on.
So Brett's the CEO and co-founder of Data World and the co-owner of Hurt Family Investments. Hurt Family, that sounds a little bit sad.
It's just my last name.
Oh, okay, okay.
Just, I thought it was just my wife and I.
I thought you were just like everybody was upset in the organization.
Right. Not that I know of.
Brett,
a pretty happy family.
Brett is a longtime entrepreneur investor. As we just awkwardly mentioned, Hurt Family is his family investment vehicle. You've been involved, you've invested, you said like 90 companies or something?
Yeah, 97 startups and 30 VC funds as well. Mostly focused here in Austin when we invest directly in startups, and then VCs tend to give us access outside of Austin. But right. The main thing I am is an entrepreneur. I spend around 80 hours a week on data.world, as the CEO and co-founder, and I've been doing that for 5 years, and this is my sixth business as an entrepreneur. So when my wife and I got married, I had $1,000 and she had $2,000, and I always joked with people that I married the older, wealthier woman. So it's the only way we've gotten in this position where we invest in startups is by being successful entrepreneurs.
There you go. So you're a big shot. You got a ton of money. You've been around the block. You've had your own companies. You've invested in companies. Tell us about this latest project you're in.
Yeah, so data.world is my sixth business, and it actually connects really well to my prior two startups that I've been pioneering since I was 26. I'm 48 years old now. So if I just kind of work backwards and then forwards, it probably will make a lot more logical sense. So I started a company called Core Metrics when I was 26 that grew out of an e-commerce site that my wife and I started where we're selling sports nutrition products, things like power bars and vitamins and the like. And we needed a way to find out what people were doing online. I grew up in an entrepreneurial family. My wife did as well. And my parents were retail entrepreneurs, and we could ask people how they found out about the store, how they navigated the store. We could interact with them. And online, we couldn't do any of that. Everything was blinded by, you know, web browsers and, you know, that old saying, you don't know on the internet if you're talking to a real person or a dog. You're just talking about hacking, and that's a great example of that. So ultimately, I needed analytics for the e-commerce site that my wife and I had built, and I built an early version of Core Metrics And we were actually able to double our online sales by finding out exactly how people were navigating, what products they were picking up, not buying, how to do targeted promotions. And we built all of that on top of our e-commerce platform. And that became this eureka moment where I thought, well, I wonder if the rest of the e-commerce world needs this. They must be much more sophisticated than I am. And I went to go talk with friends at Amazon and CD Now at the time. This is really dated. These are back where CD Now was around as big as Amazon.com. And I found out that they had a need too. One of our first customers actually was CD Now. Amazon told me they would love to buy it, that we had better analytics than they did, which shocked me, but that Jeff Bezos would fire them if they ultimately did buy our platform. But we ultimately created a big business out of that. And the thing that really turned me on about that business was the understanding you would have about your customers that you never had before. And that led to Bazaar Voice, which was the next company I started, which powers most of the world's customer reviews. And the analytical value there was just incredible. You would find out exactly why a product is flying off the shelves because people would be telling each other. It was a digital reflection of word of mouth. And you'd find out exactly why they're returning a product, or how could Samsung turn a 4-star product into a 5-star product? Because people would literally write, I would have rated it 5 stars, but I rated it 4 stars because it doesn't have this and this feature. And so customers like Walmart and Samsung just dramatically optimize the way they sell to their customers and partner to develop product together. And like Core Metrics, you know, the Bazaar Voice customer summits, like the Core Metrics customer summits, people would be talking about how they're transforming this business, their business by this new level of understanding. And all that led to data.world, which is ultimately knowledge about everything inside of a business. So we become an enterprise data catalog to the Fortune 500, where we apply a Google-like search functionality to allow them to search inside all of their online data, no matter where it comes from. If it comes from Snowflake or Oracle or spreadsheets or their SaaS applications like Salesforce or Tableau, you know, their or Microsoft Power BI, their analytics applications, it brings all that together and it allows them to become a much more data-driven business. And unlike Bazaar Voice and Core Metrics, it's literally data about the entire business. So it's been a hell of a year for us. This year with the pandemic has been a big accelerant for our business because their businesses are changing faster than they have since the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the decisions they're making about what to invest in and what to cut are very data-driven decisions. And we're at the front of that with some of the biggest companies in the US, and you know, eventually we'll be expanding globally next year.
So to be clear, you were doing this, you did this analytics company back when, what stage in like the in the web design world were you? Is that the
was 1998?
Oh wow! So yeah. cPanel and the Apache logging service. I remember distinctly.
I mean, it was back in the days where, you know, the hottest e-commerce platform these days in e-commerce is Shopify. Mm-hmm. And everybody knows about Shopify's amazing valuation as a public company. Back when I started Core Metrics, there was no standard e-commerce platform at all. There was tons of homegrown. Mm-hmm. I built my own on my own e-commerce site. You know, there were companies that were starting to come in that don't even exist anymore, like Epiphany. You probably haven't even heard of that company, or maybe you did if you active back then. And then eventually ATG came along and got bought by Oracle later, and IBM came out with WebSphere. And there was just kind of this total fragmentation of the e-commerce platform landscape. And all of that eventually got pretty much overtaken by Shopify, which I would have never predicted. If I had predicted that, I guess I would have begged my way in to be an investor in Shopify mm-hmm. while they're a private company. But it just goes to show you that it's really hard to predict at moments in time who's going to be the winner in the future. Like, nobody would have thought a company called Shopify would have beaten Oracle and IBM, for example. Mm-hmm. But
they so, didn't. So here we are now. You're a big company, data-driven, enterprise, all of that stuff. But at the same time, you pride yourself on being very mission-oriented. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so you know, I'm always trying to pioneer the next thing. That's the type of entrepreneur that I am. I've created new categories of software. Like when we created Core Metrics, the web analytics space really was super nascent. When we created Bizarre Voice, the social commerce space didn't exist at all. So we actually came up with that term social commerce and tried to socialize what that meant to the world. And at data.world, we're pioneering this new space called enterprise data catalogs. And we're also pioneering a new form of being as a company, and that's to be a B Corporation. And a B Corporation is very much a for-profit company, like Patagonia and Ben & Jerry's are B Corporations. But it also is a very mission-driven company with a strong public social component. We're actually called a public benefit corporation. And if you go back to the original companies in the United States, they were all kind of public works projects, like when this country was first being founded. And there's a great documentary called The Corporation about how, you know, when slavery was outlawed, some enterprising entrepreneurs in Congress, you know, kind of got corporation legislation passed alongside saying, hey, companies are people too. And that led to, you know, shareholder primacy and, you know, Milton Friedman and all the things we've seen about everything's about the shareholder. And there's this big movement underway, even endorsed by Larry Fink, who's the CEO of the largest investment firm in the world with over $7 trillion of assets, where now companies are starting to say, hey, all stakeholders matter. And we should take care of things like climate change. And there's really big problems in the world that just being focused on the shareholder won't fix. And that's where the B Corporation movement has really come. And there's lots of debates and lots of Milton Friedman types that you debate with on it. But essentially, you can have a very profitable, very strong, financially oriented business that also does good for the world. And the solve is to find the intersection of those two things. And that's what B Corporations are all about. So I wrote a book on entrepreneurship called The Entrepreneur's Essentials. People can get it for free at medium.com. And in the introduction to that book, I talk about how there's three phases of entrepreneurship. There's the irrelevancy phase where nobody cares about what you're doing and everybody thinks you're going to fail. Then there's the relevancy phase where it's finally relevant. You've got product market fit. People don't want you to die and they get what you do. And then there's hopefully you get to the must-have phase, which I got to at Bizarre Voice and Core Metrics, and we're going to get to at data.world, where you become a must-have platform. You become a must-have, you know, service for the industry. It's kind of like the next evolution of business. You just become part of that layer that's just the way you do things now. And the B Corporation movement is on that journey as well, where right now I'd say it's kind of in the relevant phase. It's not yet to the must-have phase, but I really believe 10 years from now, people will be asking, like, why are you not a B Corporation? Versus today they ask me, why are you and what does that mean?
What's the best way to turn a standard startup into a B Corp? How do you have to think in that terms, just real quick?
It's very simple. You know, most startups would claim that they have a very strong mission and that they're very mission oriented and that that's how they attract team members and, you know, they incentivize them with stock options. To convert into a B Corporation from a C Corporation, you just need to have 2/3 of your shareholders vote to do so. And then you're publicly committing in your corporate charter to a public social good. And you then report on how you're fulfilling that social good every couple of years. And if you ever want to deviate from that social good, you have to get shareholders to vote again to change your mission. And so the idea here is that once you become a much bigger company, let's say you become a public company, for example, like Lemonade just did, you know, the insurance company Lemonade, they went public this year. They're worth $4 billion now. They're a benefit corporation. They went from inception through IPO in that way. And if Lemonade ever wants to change their B Corporation mission statement, their public benefit statement, they have to get all their public shareholders to vote on it. And at least 2/3, or maybe it's even, I think for that, it's even 75% as threshold, have to endorse it. So it's got real teeth in the sense that this is not, you know, some bullshit mission. This is, you're actually telling shareholders in your corporate charter, and you're reinforcing it regularly publicly, that this is what we stand for. This is why you're investing in us. Don't invest in us if you don't buy into this mission, because we can't deviate from this mission unless we get the majority to approve. And we're really serious about it. And the theoretical protection that gives you is that if you get a shareholder lawsuit, for example, where people are like, hey, we just want you to fire, you know, half your team and just focus only on operating leverage, which happens all the time with corporate raiders.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. You can just say, well, that's not going to fulfill our public benefit mission. We're not going to be able to live our public benefit mission if we do that. And you have theoretical protection in that case.
Mm-hmm. Well, as corporate and all of that aside, what is your mission? What are you and the company passionate about that drove you to be a Plan B?
Yeah, it's actually a B corporation. Yeah. It's not a Plan B. Yeah. We're on Plan A.
Yeah, Plan A.
Yeah. Yeah. So the mission statement that we have that's encapsulated in the three components of our public benefit corporation mission is to be the most collaborative, abundant, and resourceful data resource for the world, like a public utility for the world. And so, for example, all of data.gov is on data.world. All of data.gov.uk is on data.world. A lot of the most important university data sets, foundation data sets, you know, nonprofit and NGO data sets are on data.world.
And did they approach you? Did they approach you, or were you just able to grab that data and just store it there?
We actually approached them at the beginning because nobody knew who we were when we first launched, right? So we approached them and we said, this is what we stand for. And it was amazing, their response. I mean, like, I honestly, you know, just being really candid with you, this is my sixth business, as I mentioned, my first B Corporation. I thought it would have a moderate benefit to the company. It turned out to be a massive benefit. I remember when Megan Smith, who was the CTO under Obama, literally stopped me at South by Southwest and pointed at me and said, I've been waiting for someone like you to come along. When she realized we were a public benefit corporation, that got us into, you know, meetings with DJ Patel, who was the nation's chief data scientist. It led to me presenting in front of all of the nation's chief data scientists at the federal level. It ultimately really made us very friendly with government because they realized, look, we're not going to charge you for this. This is a free utility for the world. And it's a place where no matter what happens, including an administration change, and you may remember when the Trump administration came in, people were terrified that, oh, there goes the open data, that there would be this centralized place that people had documented the data, had run queries on the data, have discussed the data that would live on forever. And so our mission, like, really matters. Like, we, you know, we're a very important utility for the world to collaborate on the biggest problems. And if you remember when Biden was vice president and his son Beau passed away and he set up the cancer moonshot, it was like, so 2016, right? Or 2015, right? I mean, gosh, that was ages ago. But remember how he was talking about how it's just so ridiculous that cancer researchers are so siloed. And if they had come together, then you could solve cancer much faster. Well, that kind of went the way of the dodo bird in the Trump administration. But we were early on with the cancer moonshot. And it's part of the reason why I'm so bullish about the incoming administration, because, you know, the Biden administration is going to be incredibly tech forward. It's going to be very focused on science. And some of these projects that we were engaging in will come back. But that's part of why what we do is so important. that part of what we do, by the way, does not pay the bills. That's a free utility for the world, but it gets us phenomenal exposure because over 2/3 of the Fortune 500 use us for free. And that gets a dialogue going where they start to say, maybe I can use you inside my company as well, like WPP and others have done with us over the years as they've become customers of ours.
All right. So people go to data.world to check this out, right?
Uh-huh. Data.world is.
Data.world. I'm a Star Wars guy or Star Trek guy.
Yeah. Data, like people pronounce it different ways, but the reason we lowercase data.world, we're old school programmers. I've been programming since I was 7 years old. Like sure. I said, I'm 48 now. And I grew up from age 7 to 21 programming over 40 hours a week. And we wanted people to think of this as a utility that you plug into. It's like data.world. It's almost like electricity.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's
like an object lowercase. That you can connect to, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's right.
All right, Brett, thank you for joining us on Tech Hygiene. We all good, Lauren?
We're good. Thanks for joining us, Brett.
All right. This has thank been you. Tech yeah. Hygiene.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. We will see you next week.
Tech Hygiene is brought to you by Typewriter. Typewriter is your on-demand editor, and their amazing team of writers will make your book chapter, blog post, or email shine. Typewriter editors come from places like TechCrunch, Gizmodo, and the New York Times, and they offer low bulk rates for longer work. Check it out at typewriter.plus. That's typewriter.plus.